the Races with Steve Bick. Enough! Horse racing, handicapping, interviews. This is At the Races with Steve Bick.
We're back. Our, well, I can't even call it hour anything. It's 90 minutes in, give or take. Steve Haskins going to join us. And I think I reached out. I wanted to get a visit in with Tom Ventura to get the details. You know, the Under Tack show starts on Sunday at OBS. And so those that are going to latch on and OBS October, you got the Select Yearlings on Tuesday and the Open Stock Yearlings on Wednesday. And then, of course, there's also, as we mentioned yesterday, the two-year-olds that are in training and horses of racing age option as well. They sell on the first day. They sell before the yearlings on Tuesday. So we'll get Tom Ventura in here as well to get you set up for OBS and everything you need to know and get down there and you know, getting to be, you know, got to round up your yearlings for next year. Steve Askin standing by. And Steve, the leaves are falling and the Triple Crown is over.
Finally. we're almost at next year's Triple Crown.
Exactly. Exactly right.
Got to start doing the Derby rankings already, right?
Yes. Yes. As soon
it's been
as they...
let's say it's been an unusual year. Let's put it that way. But I'll tell you what, it was. You can't say it wasn't an interesting Triple Crown. Yeah. You know, the only race. I mean, the first one, the Belmont Stakes, it wasn't really a classic. I mean, to me, as I keep saying, it was the Peter Pan with Tis the Law added to it. I mean, it really wasn't much. wasn't much of a race. But listen, you can't complain about the Derby and the Preakness. That's for sure.
Agreed. It was a great way to finish, and I'm curious because you've got the historic perspective, and you conjure that very frequently in your writing. Which recent Preakness and/or Belmont did Saturday remind you of? I invoked a couple.
The obvious one, which I wrote about in my column, was Rex the Rich's Belmont.
Yeah,
I mean it was. I mean, the parallels were amazing. I mean, it's the same cast of characters, except everything was in reverse. You know, there you had Johnny Velasquez, who was on the filly, Kenny McPeak, who had picked out Curlin, and Robbie Alvarado, who rode Curlin. You had the same, almost the same identical stretch run with the filly just in front, and the colt just can't get her. Both big, strong, scrapping chestnut fillies. You know, it was like watching the same race. The only thing different about it is that they were reversed. You had the filly on the inside this time, but it's strange that it was the same same cast of characters. And both colts were coming off a classic victory. Curlin was coming off, obviously, the Preakness, and Authentic was coming off a Derby win. So it's very eerily similar.
Yeah. Yeah. And I, you know, I initially thought about, because of sort of the spread that was between them, at a certain juncture, it also reminded me of Street Sense and Curlin in their Preakness as well, and then you fold in the filly aspect. Yeah, it had all the right elements, and it's a race that's going to stand up well.
Oh, for sure. Well, the thing about the Street Sense Curlin is that you know, after the Derby, a lot of people were conceding the Triple Crown already to Street Sense because he won the manner in which he won and just the dominance of his performance and the move that he made. Everybody said, "Well, who's gonna be the, you know, but if he gets to the Belmont Stakes, who's gonna beat him going on a mile and a half?" And then in the Preakness, was, you know, I'm standing down at the rail, you know, watching it, and Street Sense goes by Curlin at the quarter pole. Like, all right, well, he's, you know, he's got Curlin beat. And somehow Curlin comes back at him again. Now, and nobody was expecting it. I mean, everybody thought at the eighth pole that Street Sense was home free. So that was the emergence of Curlin. We found out what he was made of in that race. But we sure found out what Swiss Skydiver was made of. I mean, her career has been unbelievable. I mean, the amount of races that she's run in, and the, you know, and the horses that she's beaten. I mean, like every horse that's finished second to her was coming off either a Grade One or a Grade Two victory, and I think one was coming off a listed stake. They were all coming off of stakes victories. But to, you know, to travel all over the country like that and just keep running her race, and like I always said, you know, in the Kentucky Oaks, you know, she had a legitimate excuse. Yeah, I know Ken McPeak, you know, as usual, would say, "Oh, she should have won that race." Well, you know, first of all, talent-wise, yeah, she should have won because the filly that beat her, she had beaten by 13 lengths in the Fantasy Stakes. But I still think that, you know, coming off that mile and a quarter race just dulled her just a little bit, just enough that she couldn't pass her. But listen, even when she loses, I mean, she runs a big race. Every single race she runs. But in California, look how many different states. Forget racetracks. Look how many different states she's won in. You know, she's a pretty amazing filly. I'll tell you that. I'll tell you one thing. Kenny McPeak, he knows how to pick him out. You know, he picked out Curlin for what, $35,000. Picked up this filly for $54,000, whatever it was. And he knows how to pick out these cheap horses at the sale.
No doubt, and we have discussed that with him, you know, repeatedly. It's been a consistency, and you know, it's easy, I suppose. You know, Mark Cassie talked about this a couple of last week, maybe, or during Keeneland. You know, shopping in book four and five, and trying to find these kinds of horses. I think the horsemen, they relish that opportunity, and you know, when you buy them for $250, $350, $400 and up, you know, there's a certain expectation. But when you get a bargain and you see something, you know, in physical and in their makeup, that's very satisfying.
Well, you know, there were so many elements to this race. You know, it wasn't just a finish. It wasn't just the fact that the filly, you know, beat a colt, beat a classic winner. And the whole element of the race, to me, was fascinating. You know, it's just so interesting the way it developed. Actually, Swiss Skydiver ran the race that I thought Art Collector was going to run.
Right.
You know, 'cause I've been saying all along that to be authentic, you had to put pressure on him, you know, make him the pursuer, not the pursued. Some horses get very brave when they're on an uncontested lead, but when they have to fight back, it's a different story. And, you know, Authentic was game, and he fought hard. But having to pass a horse is a lot more difficult for a horse like that. And horses in general have a tendency to battle back when they're on the inside, much more than the outside, as we saw in the Derby. So with Art Collector being the inside speed horse on a track where you want to save ground, I thought for sure Hernandez would hold the rail and either outrun Authentic or pressure him from the inside. Now, granted, Art Collector was in a little tight at the start, but instead of sending him, Hernandez hesitated long enough for Robbie Alvarado to cut right in front of him and take the rail away from him. And, you know, Art Collector did move up into contention, but, you know, now he was on the outside of Swiss Skydiver, and he was stuck between horses. You know, I was surprised that Thousand Words actually outran Authentic for the lead, you know, at least until they hit the backstretch. So it looked like he was, you know, Velasquez was trying to keep him off him as long as he could. But being stablemates, both jockeys, you know, kept a wide distance between them so they didn't have to look each other in the eye. And then came the fascinating part of the race. You know, Velasquez apparently got tired of eyeballing his own stablemate, and he finally pushed Authentic to the lead. But in a flash, before we had a chance to, you know, before he had a chance to establish a clear lead and relax like he did in the Derby, Alvarado, in what I thought was an absolutely brilliant move, saw the gap between the two Baffert horses and knifed right in between them and caught Velasquez and Authentic totally by surprise. You know, and just like that, he's got a half a length lead, and Velasquez is pushing on Authentic, while Alvarado still had a lot of horse under him. So now it was Swiss Skydiver who was in control, with Authentic having to do something he doesn't want to do, go after another horse. And then as you watch these horses coming to the top of the stretch, what was interesting was seeing Pneumatic and Art Collector already being ridden hard and going nowhere. They actually were backing up already and losing touch with the top two. And the reason for that, the reason both those horses couldn't keep up, well, I don't know if people realize it, but that Swiss Skydiver and Authentic were running at 23-2 fourth quarter, which is unbelievable considering they had just run the second and third quarters in 23 flat and 23-3. You just don't see horses running three quarter-mile splits like that. And, you know, as I said, to Authentic's credit, he ran gamely in the stretch. And at one point, inside the 16th pole, I thought he was going to win. I thought he was just had the momentum. He gave a little spurt forward. But Swiss Skydiver gave another lunge and just wouldn't let him go by her.
Nope.
And I'll say this, even though Alvarado had never ridden Swiss Skydiver, it was as if he really did his homework because he knew exactly how to ride her, what to do with her, when to make his move on her, and what Authentic's one weakness was. And he took advantage of it. And I'll tell you another thing. The other remarkable aspect of the race was the top two opening almost 10 lengths on the field at the finish. And the reason they were able to do that was that after running those three blazing quarters, they came home in the final three 16ths and 18-2. And I got to tell you, I can't remember a Preakness winner coming home that fast. That's why she came within a fifth of a second of Secretariat's record. You just don't see horses running fractions like that and not slowing down at the end, even a little, especially a three-year-old filly and in a classic race.
Yep.
So all in all, these two horses ran their eyeballs out and put on a heck of a show. But, man, that filly, she ran an unbelievable race.
And what's fascinating, Steve, and we hit on this a little bit. I'm sure we'll discuss it tomorrow too, when we talk to Nick Tamaro. I brought it up with Andy Beyer on Monday. For those that are learning race dynamics, this was the exact opposite of the way the Derby was run, which was fast early, slow late. And here was a moderate pace early and fast late. And people, I had Andy start the conversation. I don't know if you had a chance to hear him first thing Monday, Steve, but I wanted people to understand why the 105 Beyer, people assumed because it was so close to a track record in terms of the clock that they didn't understand why, it was just kind of a solid triple digit fig. And so Andy laid it out and, he utilized the Black Eyed Susan. Particularly as an easy base, point, to make the figure for the Preakness. And it's just so interesting, and it just shows you the elements of understanding, how horses run and the differences and the nuances. And it did raise the question whether Authentic just wasn't as sharp as he was at Churchill, because it didn't seem like Johnny was using him the way he used them to such an advantage in the Derby. And I did hear what he said about how Authentic seemed to be idling in front on the backstretch, but I didn't understand. He had the opportunity to grab the race, And you addressed the stablemate issue, but he had every opportunity, and I ended up sort of leaning on authentic because I wasn't surprised that we didn't have that faster pace that everybody was counting on. I had that part. I kind of thought that, you know, could happen. But I think from a dynamic standpoint, this was really fascinating, and there's a lot to learn and digest from it.
Well, you know, the only real slow part of it, you know, was the first quarter, you know, when
right.
It went 24 and change. So, you know, that made it slow. But like I said, after that, you can't go much faster after
no.
that, after you run a opening quarter like that. I mean, to start rattling off fractions like that, you know, quarter mile splits, that's pretty amazing, really, when you think of it. When you're running 23 quarters, because, you know, like I said, they went to the first quarter in 24-2, which is where, you know, everybody was bunched up and everybody was waiting. And, you know, you would have thought that would have been a good time for Johnny to just, you know, send authentic and just
mm-hmm.
get away from 1,000 words, who doesn't have authentic speed by any means, even with the addition of blinkers. But, you know, after that 24 quarter, they couldn't have gone much faster. 23 flat for the next quarter, 23-2, and then 23-3. Excuse me, I think it was 23-3 and then 23-2. But, I mean, when you start rattling off 23 and change quarters in a classic race, in a distance
yeah.
race,
yeah.
You just can't go any faster than that. That's why I give them credit. The only slow fraction was that opening quarter, and then they all picked it up. And that's the reason why everybody else was dead already. That's why
yes.
a horse like Art Collector, who, you know, was versatile enough to sit back off the pace, so even down the backstretch, he wasn't where I wanted him to be. I wanted him to be the one to go up and challenge. I thought he would be the one to go up and challenge, because he was the one that had, the front-running speed and the class that could go up and look authentic in the eye. I wasn't expecting that kind of a move from Swiss Skydiver, even though she does have early speed. But, you know, like I said, when they start running that those kind of fractions, that's why everybody started backing up, except that those two. They just kept going.
Yep.
And came home. Like I said, I didn't do any, I didn't go any research. But I've been following the Preakness for years and covering the Preakness. And, you know, when you come home in, like, 19-2, 19-1, that's pretty fast. 18-2. I'm trying to think of a horse that came close to that. I mean, there might have been one or two. And it's hard to tell what Secretary came in because, you know, they changed the final time of the race.
Right.
And so that was, you know, it's kind of convoluted about how fast he actually ran and how fast he came home. But I don't know, you know, people don't realize because, you know, they think of closing eighths, they think of closing 16ths, they think of closing quarters. But not many people really have a grasp of what is fast as far as the closing 3/16ths because you don't really see it that often.
That's true.
But trust me, 18-2 is very fast.
Now, from that standpoint, the visual was great, and as a final act for the 3-year-old season, the classic part of the season anyway.
He looked like he was trying to actually, you know, lean in on her a little bit. And Johnny View was hitting him left-handed, even though they were close up. I thought for a second that, you know, they were gonna hit whips the way they were going at it. But, you know, Alvarado was more of a hand ride than Johnny V was.
But, no, Johnny had to go to work.
At one point around the 16th pole, didn't you think that he had a little bit of the momentum that he was going to stick
yes.
his head in front?
And yeah,
she came right
so did Kenny.
As soon as he got there.
Yep.
You know, and I was saying, you know, watching the race, I was telling Joan, I said, when he did that, I said, yeah, Baffert doesn't lose these kind of photos. as soon as I was thinking that, I mean, she came back again, and it was a great race. It really was a heck of a way to close out the Triple Crown.
The Robbie Alvarado element to this story, which
yeah, I mean, he brought him out of mothballs. I mean, you know,
yes.
like not only does he bring him from nowhere to ride this filly that he'd never ridden before, but he rode her spectacularly. I mean, maybe the best ride of the year. Yep. To make a move like that, a bold move to go between horses, I mean, it was brilliant.
He had the right.
Because once you let Authentic relax, as soon as you saw Authentic was going for the lead, if he gets clear and is able to relax, the longer you wait, the harder it's going to be to get by him, as Tis the Law found out. So he just took it to him right away, which is the way to beat him. And he seemed like he knew it. He knew that's what I had to do. So it was great. It was great. It was really it was very, very entertaining. Great way.
Great way to cap off the
weekend. That's for sure.
Yes. You also, you know, going a little bit down the chart, was very pleased for Jose D'Angelo, who you could tell was tickled to place Jesus' team in, you know, in a classic spot. So
they were thrilled.
Yeah.
Supposedly after I hadn't heard it beforehand, but afterwards I found out there was some rumblings about him that he was really, really doing great. But as
well,
soon
you
as he ran, he still finished 10 lengths behind those horses. I completely forgot about checking to get the Thoroughbred figures. I haven't seen them. I'd love to see what the Thoroughbred numbers were in that race.
I'm sure Jerry will put them up as a, you know, he always does that.
They probably
they're not up yet.
Yesterday or so.
No, they're not. They're not up yet?
Yet?
No.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Jerry wakes up at about now, so I'll reach out to him. And see. Not known as an early riser, so but I can we will check in. Let's any, you know, what else from the weekend, Steve, before we talk about the champagne and the Gold Cup and such, leading, you know, turning our attention to
the
Breeders' Cup.
The one race that stood out to me was actually a losing performance by a horse that I think off that losing performance has got a great, great shot of winning the Breeders' Cup Classic.
You're talking Code of Honor, then.
Yep. I thought that was a perfect spot for him. I would have loved to see him go in the Gold Cup again. I think he would have won the Gold Cup Saturday. It was really not that much of a field, but you know, listen, Shug put him in a mile. You know, I never second-guess Shug. I mean, he knows what he's doing. But he put him in a mile. I knew he had no shot to win that race. And Complexity is really getting good again. He's talking about a champagne winner who loves Belmont Park, who's coming off a huge race, you know, in a slop where he just got nailed at the end by win. But he was really getting good. In a small field like that, Code of Honor had everything against him. And, again, I mean, the way they came home, they came home in like 23-1 for the last quarter or so. They got 133 and change. I mean, this race, to me, sets up Code of Honor for the Classic beautifully. I mean, we already know what he's capable of doing at a mile and a quarter. All you got to do is look at his Travers, look at his Kentucky Derby. We saw how good this horse is. He, you know, he's a stamina horse. He's not a mile. He's run well at a mile. He ran excellent in the Met Mile, but he's just a good horse. He just, you know, he's, people think that he's gone off form. He hasn't gone off form at all this year, I don't think. You know, there was one race he got the Whitney had no shot because of the pace. Where they went like 49 and 113 in the Whitney. Yeah, you know, that's not what he wants. But you give him a distance race with pace, I think this horse is very live right now for the Breeders' Cup Classic. I mean, I just love the way he was running. Yeah, you know, I know he got beat, what, two lengths, two and a quarter lengths, or whatever.
Well,
but,
big,
you know, he separated himself from the rest of the field. And sometimes you just have to watch a horse. Is he tiring? Just watch his strides. This horse was running very strong at the end of this race. And like I said, he's not going to close much faster. He's not going to, in a mile race, he's not going to, in a small field like that, he's not going to close if the wind is closing in 23-1, 23-2, whatever it was. So I mean, I thought it was a great race for him. He'll be sharper in there, and I don't think it's going to be a standout. It's going to be a good field for the Classic, but it's not going to be any headliner, you know, some horse that you have to beat. You know, Improbable is probably the improbable, probably he's the horse to beat right now.
No doubt.
He's just getting really good. And you know, there's other good horses by my standards. Tom's the Tie. Yeah, they're all good horses. But you know, it's not like you have a major star in there. So I think he's going to be a decent price in the Classic. I think he's going to run huge coming off this race.
Right now, here's what you got, you know, with obviously a couple of decisions to be made, but Improbable, Maximum Security, Authentic, the Baffert Trio, Tom's the Tot, Tis the Law, By My Standards, Global Campaign, Tacitus, Code of Honor, Midcourt, and you've got decisions, Swiss Skydiver, who seems to be leaning a little bit more toward
the staff.
Yeah.
Everybody said, she's going to Classic. No, she's a three-year-old filly. Go check. I know a lot of fillies have run in the Classic. Go check how many three-year-old fillies have run in the Classic. At the end of a year like this, and she's only three, she's coming back in training next year. Believe me, next year she'll probably go in the Classic if she has the same kind of year. But it's a lot asking a three-year-old filly to go against older colts going a mile and a quarter. At the end of a long, hard year that she's had. So going into Distaff's not going to be any picnic either, going against Monomoy Girl. But the other fillies, with Midnight Bisou gone, there's no real standouts, really.
Well, I'll give you that lineup, too. Monomoy Girl, Swiss Skydiver, Valiance, Ollie's Candy, Harvest Moon, Fighting Mad, Horologist, decision was made yesterday to supplement, Point of Honor, Dunbar Road, Vexatious, CC, and Speech.
Swiss Skydiver can beat any one of those. You know, I mean, except Monomoy Girl, she's at the top of her game. And, you know, we really don't know. She's only run two times this year. And Monomoy Girl doesn't blow you away. She wins by a length or two in all four races. But the other fillies are good fillies, but there's no Beholders or Songbirds or anything like that in there. So, I think Swiss Skydiver is good. I mean, that's a perfect spot for her. She has basically one horse to beat if she runs back to this race. I don't know what this race can take out of her. You know, if you're watching on NBC, you can hear her blowing like crazy after the race, which is understandable. You know, and to run a race like that, you know she's going to be blowing right afterwards. But I know the Distaff. Listen, even Zenyatta. You know, Zenyatta had a great year. They ran him in the Distaff before they ran him in the Classic.
True. Let's. In fact, here. Let's. You mentioned we made reference to the Gold Cup, and we'll save the two-year-olds for a second, Steve. Couple of notes on the handicap division, the Gold Cup, which we knew was going to be a small field, but you got Happy Saver, as expected, and also the other three-year-old, Mystic Guide. They bookended the five-pack. Happy Saver, Prioritize, out of the Woodward third, Name Changer, out of the Salvatore Mile, Tacitus, still looking for that elusive grade one, and Mystic Guide. So those five in the Gold Cup, and at Keeneland, the Fayette, which goes the mile and the eighth, got kind of a larger and more eclectic field. Tax ends up, who's been at Keeneland for Gargan, Tax ends up in here, as well as Mr. Freeze, who, you know, after that big start to the year, has been, you know, kind of flailing away, although it does look like, you know, he's worked nicely for this. Title Ready out of the Ali Sheba, that Miranak turns back up, the South American invader, and Dale's also got Coastal Defense. Chris Block with Captivating Moon for Bob Lothenback, a homebred for
the. That might be the horse to beat.
Yeah,
he's coming off a good race at Churchill Downs.
What about
he's been consistent. He ran a good race in the New Orleans Classic earlier in the year, and you know he's a pretty decent horse. So
he needs some pace.
He looks. I mean, it's a pretty wide open field. Yeah, Mr. Freeze. You don't know if he's going to return to his form earlier in the year. You know, when he won the Gulfstream Park Mile, he ran a big race in Gulfstream. Yoan Mucho Gusto. So, yeah, he looked like you said, he looked like he was going to have a big year, and somehow he just got derailed. But you know, he's been working well for the race. And you mentioned that Mironique. I can forgive his race in the Pacific Classic. You know, it was first start in his country, and the fact that they're willing to ship him back here for this. But he was a pretty good horse in Argentina. You know, any horse that runs as big as he did in the Pellegrini, in the Carlos Pellegrini, in a 23 horse field, he just barely got beat. So he's been running in top class company there. You know, the Latino Americana is a huge race. It brings all the horses from all over South America and Latin America together. So that's a good race. So, and I have a lot of respect for Argentine horses. You know, I thought he would run better, but you know, it was his first start since March. And listen, he might not have just liked Del Mar, but this is a much easier spot for him. So, I certainly wouldn't rule him out by any means. Yeah, I don't know if there's any Breeders' Cup Classic horses in here. Obviously, we'll have to find out afterwards. But
you would think some dirt mile participants out of this.
Yeah, you know, as I said, it depends on who wins it. You know, horse like Tax, if he runs big, he'd go in the dirt mile, I'm sure. You know, and we'll see how the 3-year-old, you know, Mimosa runs coming off the Oklahoma Derby, where he ran a pretty good race in there.
Talk about the Jockey Club, and certainly you were pushing early on for the 3-year-olds to go this route, and you end up with both Happy Saver and Mystic Guide.
Yeah, I mean, you know, going a mile and a quarter, you know, I would probably lean a little bit more towards Mystic Guide. You know, he looks a little bit more like a classy horse. Yeah, Happy Saver, we really don't know much about. You know, his race in the Federico Tessio, you know, people say, well, you know, he only won the race by a length and a half. He was the 1-5 favorite. But the horse he beat, Monday Morning Quarterback, ran a pretty good race. You know, and again, it was a big gap between second and third. And, you know, I mean, he got a 94 buyer in there. It was a good race. He looks like he certainly could improve. But he's only had the 3 starts. Now, the question is he ready to go a mile and a quarter? I'm not even going to say, is he ready to tackle all the horses? Because, you know, other than Tacitus, you know, the horses are nothing really to rave about for a Jockey Club Gold Cup. Mr. Guide is a horse that I always kept, you know, thinking was going to improve and improve. And if you look at his buyers throughout his career, he's run a 72, then went to an 84, to an 89, to a 90, to a 95. So he's improving with every race. He's certainly bred to get the mile and a quarter. And it was the horse you beat in Jim Dandy came back and ran poorly in the Preakness. But Jesus's team was third in that race. And, you know, we saw what he did. And Mr. Guide, you know, it's the second race blinkers on, which I was like. I was like horses with their second race and the blinkers on. So he should only improve off there. And like I said, he should love the mile and a quarter. Tacitus, I just never know what to make of him. You know, I loved him last year when he won the Tampa Derby in the Wood Memorial, and I thought he ran a terrific race in the Derby, and I thought he was by far the best horse in the Belmont Stakes, and then he had that horrible stumble at the start of the Jim Dandy. He's just a tough luck horse, and he still ran a huge race. I mean, his race in the Jim Dandy was pretty amazing when he rallied coming up the rail. I thought he was dead after the way he broke in that race. I thought he was going to fall. You know, and then the Travis might put the blinkers on him, and he was on a lead. This is a horse who was a stone closer before that, so I didn't think he wanted to be on a lead. He still ran, yes, he ran a good second, the Code of Honor, and he came back and he ran again. He showed speed in Jockey Club Gold Cup. He was third behind Vino Rosso in Code of Honor, so you couldn't knock it. Yeah, he ran okay in the Saudi Cup. You know, Oakland was disappointing. And then he has a major breakout with the blinkers back on in the Suburban. He wins by almost 9 lengths, but he really didn't beat anything. You know, he beat Moretti, who's basically a stayer, you know, who's kind of a slow horse. So he really didn't beat much. But Woodward, I thought he had every shot to win that race. I mean, Global Campaign is a, you know, he's a very good horse, but you know, going a mile and a quarter, I thought Tacitus had a huge advantage over him. He just couldn't get by him. So, but he's, I mean, he's still the horse to beat in here. The interesting horse in here would be Prioritized, because you know he's one of these horses that just he's just getting good right now. Just, ever since Jimmy Bond took him off to the grass, you know, all of his races have been excellent. He got away with running him in the claiming race, which he won. But, you know, he's run well in every race since. And he was able to win every, you know, when they stretch him out, he gets better and better. You know, he stretched him out to mile and 16th and he improved. He stretched him out to a mile and 8th and he won in a, you know, very nice allowance win. Got a 99 buyer. And then the Woodward, he was like 5 wide going in the first turn. I said, you know, I said, you know, what is Cancel doing? Why is he keeping him that far out? So, you know, you lose that much ground, it's going to be tough to make it up. And then it was, you know, and he was wide again, and he closed well on the stretch. He ran third. He only finished a length and a quarter behind Tacitus. So if he improves again, you know, he could be one of the horses that are getting good right now. But, I mean, it's interesting. You know, it's interesting to see what the three-year-old's doing here.
Yep.
But, you know, like I said, there's no major stars in here, but...
No, it just, the most frustrating part about this, Steve, and we've talked about this over a period of years, you know, what the Breeders' Cup did to, you know, particularly the Belmont Fall Championship meet, and, you know, that had been, you know, the deciding series of races for years. And, you know, now everything is a lead up to the Breeders' Cup, and you know, strictly, you know, while there's certain value to races, obviously like the Frisette and the Champagne and the Flower Bowl and whatever, they've all taken a back seat now to Breeders' Cup, and it's unfortunate, but you know, it's really what, you know, how the game kind of evolved. Just a reality.
I'll tell you one thing, though. You know, you talk. You know, you mentioned the Flower Bowl, but I defy anybody to find a better field, by the way, than the Queen Elizabeth at Keeneland.
It's, I mean, a nice group.
Goodness, is that a good race?
Yeah.
I mean, just every filly in there. Every filly in there, it looks capable of winning this race. And there's probably like at least 4 or 5 fillies in here that are very capable of coming back and winning the Breeders' Cup Filly and Mare Turf. And what's surprising is that when you get so many good horses in here, I mean, you know, you've got Antoinette, and you've got Harvey's Little Girl, and you got Sweet Melanie, and you got Magic Attitude coming off the Belmont Oaks. Every horse in here, but to have so many good fillies in here and still come up with a really good field actually for the Flower Bowl shows you how many really good turf fillies we have this year. You know, I know the Flower Bowl, you know, it's got the older fillies, but there's a lot of good ones in here. Yeah, we don't know how good Civil Union is. I mean, she's getting good right now for sure. Then you got all these, you know, all these fillies coming off coming off the Kentucky Downs race, and you got that Cambia Park who won the Queen Elizabeth last year. So I mean, I think that can have a pretty good field. So I think the American turf fillies will be well represented this year in the Filly and Mare Turf.
It's kind of
good luck handicapping that race. Queen Elizabeth, that's a tough race to handicap.
It's, well, you got the two, you know, the two coming out of the Oaks, right, out of the Dueling Ground Oaks that are tough. And we had Todd on Tuesday, and we talked about Sweet Melania in here. Hendy Woods. Yeah, it's fun. And then the West Coast Invaders, both be interesting. You know, here's a
yeah, that, which, yeah, well, yeah, West Coast. I mean, I find her very, very interesting.
Yep, both of them. So yeah, it's fun. This is a good one. And Arno Delacour with the Leal filly. And you know, it's amazing.
Yeah,
you know, it's amazing.
Really tough. She ran huge first time in this country.
It really talks to the depth, or just the amount, the sheer volume of 3-year-old fillies, that there's another 8-pack going in the Sands Point, going a mile, 3-year-old fillies.
Right.
It's pretty crazy. Steve.
Yeah, and let's see who comes over. I mean, listen, remember, Aiden O'Brien had to scratch all his horses out of the arc. So you got to think he's going to be loaded for the Breeders' Cup. And if he sends Love, which I would think he will, I don't know if he'd go for the, run against the fillies or run against the boys. You know, she's only a 3-year-old, but she's absolutely decimated her opposition in very un-European-like style, to win the Guineas and the Oaks and the Yorkshire Oaks, you romped in all of them. Who knows how good she is? You know, a lot of people thought she was going to be the favorite in the arc over in Naval. But I'd be curious to see where Aiden O'Brien runs her. I'm sure he's going to bring her over. But all these other horses that he's got for the turf that he can bring over, the Mogul, certainly Japan. He's got a lot of Anthony Van Dyke. He's got a lot of horses he can run the turf. So it'll be curious to see what he'll be well represented. I'll say that he's got to be after scratching four horses out of the arc.
Steve, talk about the champagne. Let's round it out with some 2-year-old discussion. And you got the rematch of the 1-2 players out of the hopeful, Jackie's Warrior and Reinvestment Risk. The Iroquois runner-up comes east in Midnight Bourbon. Seems like the three of them will be the principals. And there's another three that would have to take a step forward to contend.
The thing is, you look at a race like this. Obviously, Jackie's Warrior is the horse to catch. He's obviously a brilliant horse. I mean, he's run three races, and his times have been all sensational. He's obviously very, very fast. I don't know how far he wants to go, but if you're looking at potential Derby horses, listen, Reinvestment Risk and Midnight Bourbon, they're both coming off of excellent seconds. Look like potential Derby horses. And either one of them could win this race if Jackie's Warrior comes back. The only problem is, there's nobody that's going to run with Jackie's Warrior. He should have a clear lead in here. And the interesting horse, by the way, is that even though he's a maiden, I never trust a Doug O'Neill, Paul Redham horse in a spot like this. They like to. What they say, you throw something against the wall and it sticks here, and once in a while it'll stick. Or the shotgun effect, as opposed to a rifle effect. You shoot a shotgun and it explodes, and one piece hits you. That's all it needs. And Paul Redham and Doug O'Neill, and they've stuck over some really weird ones, just taking long, wild shots with the horses. But this horse is coming off the turf, and it's a stakes race, and he ran well in the race. I thought he ran good he got beaten in the maiden race at Del Mar. Again, Delma's been very, very slow, so you can't go by the times there. But he was third in the best pal behind Weston, who's supposed to be a pretty good horse. I wouldn't go with him, except again, second race blinkers on, and I just don't trust those. When I say I don't trust them, I don't trust them to lose when they're supposed to lose, when it comes to Doug O'Neill and Paul Redham. So they're kind of interesting. The other horses, you got Run Casper Run coming from Colonial Downs. I don't know what to expect from there. Civil War's coming off of, maiden 40,000 claiming race. He just got up to win by a nose. So, I really can't consider them. But like you said, it should be between the bottom three horses. I mean, they all look like really, really special horses. We don't get big fields anymore. You're getting five, six, seven horse fields in New York these days, or on the dirt is a big field. You're just not getting big fields.
You got a little bit. What do you got? Eight in the seven or eight in the Frisette.
That's got seven.
And the Frisette, you got Vequist coming back off the monstrous performance for Butchie Reed.
That's a good race.
Yeah, the Spinaway winner.
Yeah, that you remember her? She didn't get a monster buyer number. She got a 74, but visually speaking,
yes,
her first start was pretty devastating. I mean, she really looked good. Just watching her stride out, she's a beautiful striding filly. She will run all day. They spent $950,000 for her, but she bought Medaglia Dora out of a flatter mare, so she's going to run all day. But boy, did she look good from a visual standpoint. I know 118 is nothing to rave about, going 6.5 furlongs. But, you know, again, it was a deep track that day, and she just was an absolute standout. You know, and she just won as she pleased. So she's going to be interesting here. Like you said, Vequist, you can't knock it. You know, you win a spinaway in 122-1 and run off by over 9 lengths. So, I mean, she's obviously going to be very, very tough in here. But, I mean, all these fillies, you know, Day Out of the Office hasn't run since she won the Schuylerville, but she looked awfully good. She's undefeated. She won the Schuylerville. Another Intermischief, of course. What else is new? But, you know, these are all good fillies. You know, even a filly like, Asmussen's of the filly, Joy's Rocket, you know, she's coming off. She's only coming off of 5.5 furlong races, but she's coming off of turf and a synthetic performance, and she's got a lot of speed. So, I mean, she could outrun everybody in this race.
You know, Steve, we had the conversation with Mike Trombetta after he won the Presque Isle Deb race with Mrs. Weber's Sweet Super Sweet, who had run in that Bolton Landing. The third, fourth, fifth, and sixth place finishers out of that Bolton Landing, I put this up on Twitter, they've all come back to win stakes. It's the craziest key race stat you'll ever see. So Joy's Rocket is the next runner to come out. Toby's Heart hasn't run back yet, but if Joy's Rocket should happen to win this, it would make 5 for 5 of fillies out of the Bolton Landing winning stakes.
That's pretty wild,
crazy.
But really, obviously, I mean, she's very fast. I mean, she's gonna go 22:45. I mean, she does. She has in all of her races. You know, and she keeps going. So I can't even tell you if she's going to like stretching out, because I have no clue about her pedigree. She's by Anthony's Cross out of a special rate mare. I mean, I have no idea who they are.
Well,
she's obviously very, very fast.
Well, even with that pedigree, though, for her to sell it for $47,000 at OBS March, she must have worked decently well in the Bree show.
Yeah.
Because that obviously is.
She's coming off of a few minute and change 5 furlong works over in Oklahoma. That's a good. That's fast at Oklahoma. You go 1:03 and 1:04. I mean, that's pretty fast on the Oklahoma training track. So we know she has speed. Now you would think if you're feeling like Vickquist, being on the rail, he's got to go out, and she's got tremendous speed too. I mean, she also runs 22s and 45. The last race, when she won the spinaway, she went 44-4. So she's got speed. So, I mean, it could be a speed duel, but I would think Joy's Rocket will still outrun her. And we don't know. You know, like I said, coming off the turf, it'll be interesting. She's run once on the dirt, and that was in a slop. So she's never run on a fast track before, a fast dirt track.
Well, she as and I just pulled her up. She was hip 338 at OBS March, and she went in 10 flat.
That's the best. I'll take it.
Yeah, on the synthetic, and you know, Anthony's Cross. If I'm not mistaken, that Owen Hardy, I think, trained Anthony's Cross.
I think you're right. I have heard of him.
And
I remember him. I can't remember what he did, but I definitely remember the name. I never saw him as a stallion before.
He won the Bob Lewis. How about that as a 3-year-old?
Okay, that's probably where I heard him from. Him. Right. Okay. Now that's starting to come back to me now. Okay.
In 2011, and. It is a fun pedigree. You got the dam is by a special rate. The second dam, Solo Rolo, by Air Forbes 1.
Oh, my goodness. Wow, that's going way back.
How about that?
For that close up in the pedigree?
Well, yeah.
We're going way, way back.
Well, the second dam got Patty's Pride, who was a nice stake horse.
Yeah. I might be wrong, by the way. I can't. I'm not quite sure, but it's possible Air Forbes One might have been the favorite in the Kentucky Derby.
This is what a funny. It's so funny. That's the best part of it. That's why we love this, because you find things that just,
I love seeing names like that. You know,
yeah,
names that you don't think of as stallions, but you remember them as racehorses.
Yep.
You know, and they show up in a pedigree. Air Forbes One. I don't know if I've ever seen Air Forbes One in any pedigree ever.
Well, and even Special Rate is an unusual, just to, you know, to see, you know, on a sire line. Sid and I talk about this kind of stuff all the time. I mean, it just, mm-hmm. he was Judmont bred him. And
that sounds familiar. That name is starting to come back to me. I think of him with Judmont. Yeah.
Yeah. And by pulpit, center pulpit, out of a Nureyev mare, and he stood in Texas and Oklahoma.
Especially, you know, nowadays, you know, it's not like we, you know, the old days when you saw a bold ruler. Nowadays, these good horses can come from anywhere.
That's for sure.
Any stallion, it's just crazy now with the pedigree. It's so spread out. You know, where you go, by the way, there's always going to be AP Indian there somewhere. And then you're going to find Mr. Prospector. Every other horse is inbred to Mr. Prospector. But you're starting to see stallions now, like sons of sons of sons and stuff. And they're showing up now. And these good horses can come from anywhere.
No doubt. Special, and you know, Special Rate, actually, Special Rate himself actually had a really nice, he was beautifully bred. Third dam was Chris Everett.
Wow.
And second dam was Nijinsky Star. Any number of nice names come out of Nijinsky. The Nijinsky Star appears in, I want to say, Groupie Doll. I think is Groupie Doll's second, second dam, or has something that name absolutely ties to Groupie Doll, Nijinsky Star. Anyway, easily sidetracked.
Pedigrees have become very, very interesting. Like I said, everything is spread out, and you're always going to see names in there that you know, and horses that you remember racing, and you completely forget all about. You know, like an Air Forbes One that are going to show up in a pedigree.
Well, you've even got.
But I mean, Chris Everett in the third generation.
Yeah.
I mean, that's pretty close up. Normally, you're going to see Chris Everett, you know, in fourth or even, you know, fifth generations.
Well, having Air Forbes One involved, he's the broodmare sire of the dam of this horse, Queenie's Pride, her dam, Solo Rolo, 1995. So she 95 and Queenie's Pride, 95. No, she was only six at that point. But 95 would have been 95 Air Force. And Air Forbes One was, he was 16 when he would have been 16 when he covered Solo Disco to get that dam. There's also, you know, there's an interesting get on the bus, the Redham Uncle Mo filly, Steve, that you'd mentioned, that's the maiden, is a Joe Allen product out of a mare. This is something I don't recall seeing all that often. You got a Dubai bred mare.
A Dubai bred mare?
Yes, you, the mayor of Get on the Bus who's my Uncle Mo, is out of Storybook, who was bred in Dubai. By Joe Allen.
I don't know if I've ever seen any Dubai bred mares.
Nope. Me neither. Storybook is her name. And this was a $340,000 also OBS March. That Dennis O'Neill must have bought this horse.
Yeah, I would. Yeah, I would think so. But if you get a chance, check on Phillips Rome because I'm pretty sure he was a favorite in the Kentucky Derby. It was one of those crazy Kentucky Derbies. I think it was like might have been like Gatto del Sol's Derby.
Yeah, 82 it would have been, right? Because he was born in 79.
Yeah. If you look that Derby up, I think he might have been the favorite. And you know, the thing is, he was by both Forbes, so you know, you don't see too many. You don't see both Forbes in too many pedigrees either.
No, I had my Derby guide. Tina, while I was in Kentucky, Tina decided she was going to rework my office and my auntie office, and it looks better.
It looks better,
but she moved my library, where my books were. They're not all in, you know, an arm's length, an easy reach like they used to be. So there's been a few days where I've turned to reach for something and it's not there. This is one
that's
of
what
those
I mean.
Times.
That's what I mean. It doesn't sound good.
Oh, too funny.
After this weekend, then we just, you know, nothing to do but coast to the Breeders' Cup. And that's going to be strange having the Breeders' Cup with nobody there.
Well, I got to mention to you, we've provoked a couple of favorites. Pat Kelly is chipping in, saying Air Forbes 1 was one of the favorites for the Derby because Pat was there with Laser Light.
Oh, of course. Laser Light ran second in the race, sure. Not only that, but Laser Light was flying.
Well, that would have been nice for Mrs. Weber. And Eric Hamelbeck chips in that Yanks Music was Adina's first $1 million mare, and she was by Air Forbes 1.
That's funny. Did you say Yanks Music?
Yanks Music.
Boy, I remember her. She was a hell of a filly.
Yes, she was. I saw Yanks Music.
You remember who she kept beating every race? Couldn't beat her?
Ooh.
Serena Song.
Okay. Good job.
Serena Song could never get by her. And this is when she was running against all the fillies, Yanks Music. It was like in the Beldame and all, in those races at the end of the year, running against Serena Song. And Serena Song was closing out her career. And she was trying to close out her career with a victory. And she could not get by Yanks Music. Leo O'Brien trained her.
Correct.
She was a very, very good filly. She was
3-year-old champion.
She got hurt after that, and she didn't run as a 4-year-old. But she was terrific. Oh, I tell you, all these names that are popping up.
Well, you know what's funny?
Yeah, I mean, Pat would certainly know. But Laser Light was flying at the end of that race to get second. He was like a big price too. I think it was like 25-1 or something like that. It was a huge price.
There's something funny about Yanks Music that can be tied to current racing, which is her dam traipsing, and there's a filly out there right now named Traipsing.
Oh, really?
Yes.
That's another thing too that always fascinates me when you see horses that you remember so well, and then you see their names pop up again. You know, it's like sometimes, by the way, you'll go on like Equine Line to start looking at a horse, and there's like 15 of them with the same name.
I know. Well, the horse we named, our 2-year-old or McLean's music. We named Scherzando, and there's been a North American Scherzando, but it's an Italian word, and so it didn't surprise me. There's been a couple of European versions of the name used.
Yeah, that's why I love that's why I absolutely love looking at pedigrees.
Steve,
they always fascinate me because there's always something there that you can find that you recognize, you know, some names in there, and sometimes you just look at them and they just bring back memories.
All the time. The best part,
if I remember correctly, is that she was in that great Green Tree family. That had like Stop the Music and Hatchet Man and those horses, and I remember that. I remember she was from a really strong Green Tree family.
Steve, let me wrap it up, and we'll look forward to another big weekend, Keeneland and Belmont particularly, and then we'll really start to focus in. Start to get those fields together.
Then it's on to the Breeders' Cup. It'll be an interesting one.
Steve, before we go, by the way, I should mention and give you a chance to quickly plug Secretariat Fest, right, this weekend. What's going on?
In fact, I took a break from it, but. As a lead-in, I decided what I was going to do as a lead-in to the festival. I opened my Facebook page up to questions and answers for people to just ask me anything they want. It could be about racing in general, about Secretariat, about the Vox Populi, about me personally, personal questions, professional questions, or anything like that. So I've been answering questions, you know, live. Just they come on, they ask, and I answer it immediately. And then the Secretariat Festival is going to be, it's obviously it's all virtual, but there's going to be a virtual tour of Claiborne Farm. They'll take you around to see all the stallions. Michael Blowen is going to be doing a virtual tour of old friends. It's going to be a panel discussions with Ron Turcotte and Lafitte Pinkai. You're going to talk about Secretariat and Sham.
Fun.
And it's going to be moderated by Lafitte's son. Pat Day is going to be doing. He's going to be talking, and going to be a lot of fascinating people there. Eddie Maple will be there, and like I said, all kinds of virtual stuff, all kinds of virtual
cool.
tours, farm tours, panel discussions, and you know, and it's all free. You know, people can just come on there, and some of the virtual tours you have to. Sign up for, but all you have to do is just go on to the website and just put your name in there. That's all.
Cool.
Because it's done on Zoom, and Zoom, you can only have so many people. So you sign up for that. The other stuff, you just go on there on the Facebook page. You know, the Secretariat Festival Facebook page, Secretariat.com Festival page, and all the virtual stuff will be on there. And there's merchandising. You can go into the store and buy all kinds of interesting stuff. You know, they have. There was one thing where they Leonard dug up all these old. Some woman just gave him all this stuff, tons of stuff. But she gave him all these old AP and UPI photos. And there's one photo that's unbelievable. It's a photo of Secretariat and Sham eyeballing each other before the Preakness Stakes. That's fascinating. So interesting
cool.
photos and memorabilia. So it'll be interesting.
Nice. Well, secretariat.com and Steve Askin, everybody. Steve, thanks.
All right, Steve. You take care.
Steve Askin, folks, and Secretariat Fest this weekend. Staying right here. We got half an hour, and Tony and Rich Eng to come. Tony Black standing by. Good morning.
Good morning, Steve. Interesting show. Always a pleasure to be on. And there were so many good things to talk about when it comes to the Triple Crown Series this year, but the best thing about this year's Triple Crown Series is we only have 7 months to wait for next year's Triple Crown Series.
Exactly right. It's right on top of us already. It's very funny. It's that part of it is going to take is going to kind of take us by storm pretty quickly. You know, the Breeders' Cup gives rise immediately to the to the run up toward the Classics. Tony, your thoughts about what transpired? I don't know how much of what I've said this week you were able to hear, but I'll reiterate that I was very surprised. I don't know if Johnny didn't have the same amount of horse that he had at Churchill, but he had the opportunity to kind of control the race the way he had in the Derby and didn't seem to take that opportunity.
I'm right there with you. I didn't seem to take that opportunity, especially take that opportunity at a track like Pimlico. I think he, my thought right after the race was, and I can hear Nicky Santagata yelling, if this happened to one of us when we were all riding together, he would be yelling when we come back to the jock's room. He would look at the jock that let the winner through and say, easy pass, easy pass. and Nicky would make sure that he'd catch you in a moment where you didn't want to hear easy pass. But, when horses run, Steve Haskin made a point. He said when horses run on the inside, they get real game at times and they really run hard. That's true when they get head and head with you. If they don't get real game, if you squeeze them up against the fence and you don't let them get head and head with you. But when a horse, and this is old school thinking, When I can remember coming around the old school riders, if you were going to beat me, and it didn't matter if the fence was the place to be or not the place to be because of track bias, if you were going to beat me, you were going to come around me and beat me. It was embarrassing to get beat by a horse that would sneak through on the inside. It would be almost one of those things where you felt not just embarrassed, but you would think, man, I slipped up. I let this horse get up in there. If he was going to get up in there and beat me, you almost wish he'd beat you by five or six lengths. When he beat you by a nose and got up on the inside of you, it just was an unsaid thought that would go through every rider's mind in that jock's room. And it would be embarrassing to get beat like that. But that never was a question when it came to this race. This race was a kind of a race that was run where I think at times everybody over-strategized the running of the race because they were stuck on what people get stuck on. A lot of speed. Whenever there's 3-4 speed horses in a race or 3-plus speed horses, everybody says, oh, it's a lot of speed. And I find out more times than enough, when you focus on speed because there's multiple speed horses in the race, more times than enough, if you go, be the rider that goes, a lot of times you'll catch everybody else sitting. And they'll be sitting there, and you'll actually make a lead easy or is easier because there was multiple speed horses in the race. And when I looked at Baffert's other horse, I think that because Authentic had an outside post, his other horse had a post where he showed speed and was on the inside. I felt like that horse was put in there as a horse to make sure that the pace was honest if somebody else wanted to go and everybody was sitting thinking, oh, there's too much speed in here. He was going to be the one that goes and make sure that someone just didn't make an easy lead. He was like a security blanket in the race. That's what I looked at him as. And when he came out of there good, that was good. And I give Johnny credit and the other rider credit. They didn't bother each other when they came away from the gate and they both were near each other. It didn't affect Authentic's race at all. And it wound up being actually showing how riders can really use their heads, even if they do have a stablemate in there, and they really use their heads. They didn't blast that first eighth or quarter and hurt each other. They really didn't hurt each other. The thing that I just got focused on was, at Pimlico, as is one track that has a reputation of being a little bit of a speed bias racetrack, and a little bit of a track that you always want to protect the inside. And I just think that's where Johnny messed up, by letting that filly up in there when if she had to come around. When you have to get, when you get up in there and you run as game as she did and she still won it by a nose, she came around, she wasn't going to win it by a nose. If she came around, she was a beat horse. And I think Authentic kind of ran his race. Maybe he didn't run as powerful as you saw in his previous win. But I don't think Johnny rode him as powerful. I think Johnny messed up. I really do. And I could hear Nicky yelling, easy pass, after the race. Even though I know he wouldn't do that if Johnny was around, or if he was around Johnny, because you can't do that, especially when you're not a jockey anymore. But it made me think of Nicky. Here I'm thinking of Nicky Santagata when we're looking at the Preakness. And I'm thinking, why am I thinking about Nicky, except I can hear him yelling now? Because he used to do it at parks all the time. And he'd drive them kids crazy, and the riders that didn't want to hear it. You didn't want to hear it. You just got beat, and the horse got through on you. You didn't want to hear Nicky coming back yelling, easy pass.
I'm going to use that when I see him. I might see him as early as Sunday, actually, at Belmont. I'm going to give him that easy pass. I love it.
Yeah,
that is too
exactly
funny.
What you mean? Because he used to break them on everybody at parks.
Too funny. Well, and you know, I don't want to dwell. I don't want to make this about the opening that was provided because Robbie Alvarado's decision. I mean, talk about Robbie's part in this, Tony. And there had to be plenty of pressure for Alvarado under these conditions, where you know there was this, you know, eye rolling reaction to him even being named. What's been a difficult couple of years for him, and his career. He's 47, and people kind of scoffed at him getting this mount, and all he does is essentially make the difference here. I mean, the filly's got to give you the output, but he's the one who seized the opportunity to win the race when he did.
Absolutely. A lot of times riders spend most of the time while they're riding a horse out there looking to get to an outside position, because horses do run free and clear, and when they're free and clear, they run sometimes even harder. He didn't, he was in traffic, didn't look to like force his way out, stayed where he was, and he wound up, because of his mindset and his thought, capitalizing on being stuck on the inside. And you're right about one thing. When riders let their confidence be shaken because they're not winning that, five, six, seven, eight races a week, and they're going through a career change, and then, of course, everybody sees you're breathing on 50, 47, 48, and you're not winning at the rate you were used to winning at, and you're not getting the recognition that you were used to getting on being in the big races and winning them. It does put an added pressure. But I think the longer you're in that mindset, you get used to that mindset that people place on you. Well, I'm not doing that good. Jeez. Yeah, and you start shaking it off and say, you know what? I know what I'm doing. I've been out here doing it. You've had 30,000 races. You've been out doing it 20,000 races. You've done it long enough. You know that a big part of it is who you're riding for. It's not like you're screwing up every day. Sometimes you're just not getting the opportunity to get on the live horses, and you shake it off. The one thing that he did have going for him was, even though she is a world-class filly, she was asked to do something that was a lot to ask of her, putting her in a race like that. And credit to McPeak. I mean, he put her in there, and he had no hesitation in saying he was going to run her. And you got to give the guy credit. Now, when it comes to a rider, if she didn't run her race, if she didn't run that good, you come back and say, it's a filly. It's a tough spot that she was in. And you can shake it off. But the one thing that you do hit on and you key on is Robbie isn't doing what he had done in previous years. That's a tough thing to handle. But I'm sure because it's not just happen for a few weeks or a few months. He's been going through this transition. He's handling it pretty good. And you can't take anything away from the Phillies. Of course, you can't just take anything away from his ride and the Phillies' performance. They both performed to the optimum. They really did both did a great job. You got to give them a lot of credit. And I give Steve Haskins some credit, too. He does realize horses, when they get up to that point head-and-head with a horse, the inside horse a lot of times will run game. And I think at one point, I saw a head-on just once, where Johnny realized, I think, oh, man, she's in here, and it's too late now. And he did try to cock his horse's head in to to that horse. And, you know, a lot of times you say, will it intimidate her? Well, at that point, in that kind of a filly, she's not intimidated. It actually makes you gamer at times. Do you know at times where I've gotten a little bit of success and it's hard to do? Once you let a horse up in there and they're head-to-head with you and you can't cock the horse's head in and intimidate them, you're almost better off drifting away from them. Hit your horse left-handed, drift out, drift away. And sometimes they'll lose a little focus, the inside horse, on your horse, and your horse will quit making him game. You know, your horse on the outside sometimes makes the inside horse game.
That's interesting, Tony.
Yeah, it really is. And you know what I've also seen? I've seen horses in the outside of a horse kind of come up to the inside horse, try to get past him, and won't really get into it to get past them, and you'll see a horse come up on the outside of the outside horse, and that horse will make your horse start running. So it's amazing how inside horses at times in certain positions actually run gamer. And you'd say, well, you know, the only time they really don't run this game is if you're the inside horse and the outside horse is pressing you up against the fence. You can intimidate them. But when there's daylight between the fence and horses and at times, you know, the inside horse just really puts its heart into it. But it's amazing. I've seen where a horse coming on the outside just can't quite get past that inside horse, you know, putting it in a different focus. And you'll see a horse running to the outside, come running, and the horse now is in the middle, and he'll dig in and run hard. So it's horse racing, and it's hard to figure them sometimes. But my hat's off to McPeak, that filly, and Robbie. Did one great, great job.
You know, it's funny that you define that and you flesh that out. And I've got on the DVR downstairs, I've got the win from earlier this year that Kid Chocolate had at Belmont. And I bring this up because on the TV broadcast, it was Greg Wolf and Rich Migliori. And if Mig is, well, he's actually working today, so he's probably not listening now. But if he was, he would send me a note. Rich made the point to Greg exactly what you're saying, and there was a big long shot, literally 100-to-1 shot that was leading, and the favorite was having trouble getting by, and Kid Chocolate was third, kind of tracking behind them, and Manny Franco kicked him outside, and he goes by them to win. And when he did that, the favorite that was trying to get past this 100-to-1 shot and looked like he was hanging, the favorite actually then surged, but not until Kid Chocolate went past him. And Greg made the point. He said, well, the favorite finally got by. And Mig said exactly what you just said, which is, yeah, but he might not have gotten by if it wasn't for the winner, Kid Chocolate. When that horse comes up outside of him, it carries the other horse that's trying to get past the inside horse. It's amazing the way this flow works.
Yeah, it is amazing. It's amazing just how competitive these horses can be when they're placed in certain situations. And more times than enough, you'd be on a horse and you're fighting to get past the horse that was on the lead, and you know you're maybe not going to get past them. Somebody would show momentum on the outside of you, and your horse would take off as soon as he caught the outside.
Amazing.
It happens like that. And you know, I'm glad you pointed out a specific, and you believe what I'm saying.
Oh, yeah.
I experienced it time and time again. You know, I experienced the position of being on the inside, the middle, the outside, and horses' momentum, how it changes when they're placed in certain situations like this. And that's a great example. What you just gave is Kid Chocolate. And you know what? It happens more times than enough.
And Tony, I don't think I've ever heard anybody explain that or suggest that. I mean, the assumption is, and I would also myself assume that if this happened in, you know, in live action, observers would say, why did the jock do that? Why did the jock move away from the horse?
They would think
that it was being done for the opposite reason that it's being done, to sort of disengage and then maybe be able to surge. That's fascinating.
Yeah, and you hit right on it, to disengage, and it's hard to do. You know, you're coming down the stretch and you're the outside horse, and the horse on the inside's already been head and head with you. He's not a half a length off you. And there's a big difference if that inside horse is a half a length off you and you cock your horse's head in and you got his body laying into the other horse's head. Yeah, you might intimidate him. But once he gets head and head with you, you're not intimidating him now. You're making him game. He actually wants to run harder. And it would be hard, like you said, to disengage by saying, I'll strike my horse left-handed and I'll make him drift out away from him. Because then they'll say, man, you not only let him up in there, but now you're drifting a woman out. You're losing momentum going to the outside and drifting out. Well, you're trying to get his competitive level, the inside horse's competitive level, to lessen, you know? And I'll get away from him and maybe he'll quit running.
Amazing.
As hard as he's running.
Amazing.
He'll lose focus of me. But it's hard to do. You know, it's hard to do, and that's why you don't see it, because it's an unusual move, and it can be interpreted two ways. Well, he got away from him because he thought it would make the inside horse less competitive, or he got away from him because he's sitting left-handed and he screwed up. You know, it's two ways.
Well,
simultaneously,
Tony, you could also fold into this discussion the circumstance where two different circumstances, either a horse that is on the lead and there's somebody coming and a rider will steer not trying to herd necessarily, but trying to make sure that your mount sees the oncoming horse. Because there's plenty of occasions, if there's three, four paths between you, the horse will come by, and if your horse doesn't see competition, they might be idling a little bit. And then there's the other option, which is the oncoming horse, and, you know, you purposefully staying clear so that the horse that you're chasing doesn't see you coming.
Right, absolutely. I've seen, extreme cases like that where you've gotten beat because a horse bolted and came down the outside fence and your horse didn't get sight of him and he had enough momentum to get by you. Yeah, that's a situation that can occur. You know, where the other situation that can occur is, let's say you're on the lead, and when you talk about herding, there's a point where it's herding and it's an infraction, and there's a point where it's herding a horse, but you're not crossing the line. And I love to be on a lead horse that you know you could shake up coming to the head of the lane, and coming to the middle of the turn or the elbow of the turn, you would see a horse coming at you from the outside, and you would start to let your horse drift out, because he would have to follow you out. Now, they say, well, you're losing ground, so what purpose does that serve? Wait a minute. I'm taking this horse out. He doesn't know to what degree I'm going to take him out. He has to follow me out. I'm not losing ground. He's the one who's getting slightly herded, and I'm causing a problem for him because he has to follow me out and doesn't know where I'm going to stop. And just right at the elbow, the ideal situation is right at the elbow when your horse is on his left lead, you stop herding out and you pop him to his right lead and drop in and you left him out there. That's a situation that can occur when you're riding speed horses. You know, you can carry them out, leave them out there, drop in, and you separate yourself from them again. You know, and doing it where you're coming to the head of the lane or at the stretch, you know, you've cost that horse momentum, and you've got your horse where he's popped over because you dropped him in, and usually when you switch horses to drop in, they'll pop over to their right lead. An ideal situation. You know, the lead situation is at times one of my pet peeves, because everybody says, oh, he's on his wrong lead. And then I'll say to myself, well, what lead was he on for the most part in the early stages of the race? If he's been on his right lead and you snuck him around the first turn on his right lead, and he went down the backside on his right lead, and he went all the way into the 3/8 pole, and he's now just switched over to his left lead, and his left lead is fresh lead, get around the turn, and if he doesn't want to change lead up the stretch, he's on his fresh lead. It's not so much left and right, it's fresh. Fresh lead is sometimes more important than right lead, left lead.
Well,
but, you know, you've heard that story from me before,
sure.
Steve. So.
This also fits into our conversation as you talked. It made me think to, you know, the opening moments of the show when I talked about what happened at Indiana yesterday. You had three takedowns, Tony, on a 10 race card, one being a quarter horse race, but nine thoroughbred races, three separate DQs, two were pretty clear cut, and in fact even encouraging the way we view, you know, stewards and concerns about them being proactive, and then one was seemingly pretty silly, and I didn't get a chance to direct you to any replays, but one was at the start of a race where the horse kind of comes out maybe third jump and clips heels with the horse to the right, and the horse almost went down, and they, you know, seemingly rare that stewards take action, you know, the first few jumps, but it really did seem warranted. Then there was a classic herding case where a lead, you know, horse on the lead came out 2.5-3 paths to meet the oncoming horse the way we're talking, and, you know, really did clearly herded, and the race was decided by a head bob, so it's easy to assume that the herding affected. And then one of them was a hip check as the winner was going by a tiring horse, and they placed the winner behind the fourth place finisher, which just seemed really unnecessary, but it absolutely did knock that other horse off stride. So it was there was all kinds of activity that you know, that I was thinking to you this morning as I started the show.
Sometimes it's tough being in that steward stand, but you know, it's also so tough to take a win away from an owner and a jock, especially an owner, you know, with all they have invested.
Sure.
And it is something that really didn't cost the horse that was bothered a more forward position, and it didn't really change the outcome of the race to any great degree. It's hard to penalize an owner like that, my heart goes out to those guys that get taken down, and the horse that they bothered, you know, wasn't a significant factor, wasn't going to finish much better in the race. But I guess sometimes they go sticklers, they go by the rules, and the rules sometimes should be cut, and they're cut and dry, and I think all rules are meant to be interpreted to fit the circumstances that you are viewing at that particular time. But they told me I couldn't be a steward, so what do I know?
Well, it's one of the great inequities, really, that you know, somebody like you, that, you know, 30,000 plus mounts, and you know, understands all the intricacies that, you know, as they're happening out there in real time. I mean, that's the you know, that's the part of it. And this isn't to say that every steward, you know, just because they haven't ridden, they can't understand the dynamics and so forth. But that incident going. Now it's a while. What year did you take the course?
It had to be about, let's see, 20. I guess it was around 2013. I got my rope accreditation.
That feels about right. So I was going to say as much as 8 or 10. Yeah.
It had to be 7, 8 years ago. And I understand where they come from, and you said it correctly too. There are students that never sat on horses back that do understand. They do. You know, they do understand what it's like to be out there without having that riding experience. So, you know, that's being really fair. And maybe there's some people that were stewards, jockeys that were stewards that forgot what it was like to be out there, and they don't do a good job either. I'm sure we could cite some cases, but I'm not going to mention any names.
I love it. Wow.
But, you know, the Department of Agriculture in Pennsylvania said, well, you didn't work 100 days in administrative office, so you don't qualify. Don't even hand in your, don't even apply for the job. I said, okay. Charlene Miller told me that. And I thought, well, I wonder how many races she watched. Being in the Department of Agriculture, I don't know. But maybe she could grow corn. I don't know. Maybe she grew good corn. I'm not sure. I'm not sure, Charlene. You're listening. Maybe you're a good farmer. You were in the Department of Agriculture. You must have known something about agriculture.
We can only insult somebody here, Tony. There's no easy egress from this. Tony, I appreciate it. We're going to wrap up for this Thursday, and we'll talk next week.
Talk next week. And once again, Steve, keep up the good work. And hats off to Steve Haskin. He calls a lot of shots just right on. I'm not sure he wasn't a race rider somewhere along the line. Take care. Keep up the good work, Steve. Thanks.
Tony, be well. Tony Black, everybody, along with Steve Haskin, Dick Powell, and Tim Schramm started us off. I just put up the, in the last 20 minutes or so, I put up the thank you to Tim's visit and the link to the BCBC, BreedersCup.com/BCBC, with all the details. All right, so that's there for you. I apologize to Rich. We didn't get to Rich Eng today, but I thought that was very valuable. That's the first time I've ever heard that but it makes perfect sense about disengaging and you know, getting a horse to maybe be less competitive, you know, at that juncture, and then maybe being able to, you know, still take your momentum and get by while the other one eases up. That really interesting. Good luck today, everybody. You got a variety. Obviously, Belmont back today, and there's some good allowances in the middle of the card. State Bred going 6 on the main, and then fillies and mares, open company, 6 on the turf, including Notorious RBG. Looks pretty good in there. And at Keeneland, I told you about that sequence, including that money allowance, mile and 16th on the turf with Mr. Dumas, who looks good in there. Spectacular Gem, personal favorite, Jimmy Baker. Title Ready looks okay in here at a price for Dallas Stewart. All right, I'm going to play a little bit, and maybe we'll do a little live tweet handicapping later, because I didn't get to write anything up today. Weekend preview tomorrow, Dave Grenig, Nick Tamaro, Scully, Hammer, much, much more. Good luck today, everybody. Thanks for tuning in. Talk to you in the morning.
It's At the Races with Steve Beck on Sirius XM Radio.
Our Pennsylvania breeding program was, of course, impacted by the pandemic. Now, with our country getting back to work, we'd like to again talk about our program, The Best in North America. Our breeder awards will remain up to 50% for PA-sired PA breds. Owner bonuses will also stay at up to 40%. Restricted races will again be run at all three PA tracks, and PA Day at the races will return. I'm Brian Sanfratello. For more, please visit PABred.com.